You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Coming up on the free-for-all, this guy might have a case as being the most interesting man at the Wall Street Journal. Correspondent Ben Kessling. We'll talk about his extraordinary career before getting into newspapering and then talk to him about this presidential race that he is on the ground covering before Super Tuesday. Coming up, Free for All.
You're listening to Free for All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Yes, here is Jason Gay. The one, the only, the unfortunate, the pathetic, the sad, whatever you want to call him. He's here. That's me. It is less than Super Monday, Jim. Are you getting excited for Super Tuesday tomorrow?
It is. I'm also excited today's Leap Day.
I don't even get the whole Leap Day thing. So this is like if you have a birthday on this day, you don't exist.
It's once every 4 years, right?
Okay. So technically,
you're not that excited.
last night, Oscars. Jim, would you gamble on the Oscars?
You know what? I was looking at the odds for the Oscars. I did actually take a look at the odds.
Yeah.
But the odds are so overwhelming towards the likely winner. Like Leo was 1 to 50 or something
right.
like that. So it's not. I actually considered it that the odds on Eddie Redmayne was like 10 to 1 or something as
right.
the second
so
choice.
Why not? Yeah.
It was like, why not? Throw a couple bucks, but I didn't.
I did not watch the Oscars. I watched the Chris Rock monologue, which I thought was pretty good. What do you think?
Good, good. You know, I mean, you can watch the Oscars the same way you can watch an NBA game now, right? I mean, I'm sure they have vines of the joke, the best joke.
Yeah,
things like
I mean,
that
was my argument in not watching. My wife was shocked that I retired early at 9:45, but what's the point? You can see everything you want to see the next day. You can see Leonardo DiCaprio. But the shocker was Stallone, I presume. That was a big deal that
right.
Stallone did not win.
Right. He was favored
what
in the odds,
What were the odds
too.
There?
He was favored in the odds. He was below even money to win. And the guy that won was 2-1. So that was good value there in that betting.
Yeah. Do they put a limit on the Oscars? Because they know. I mean,
I think
somebody knows.
Right, right. I think yours max.
Okay. We have a very exciting guest today, somebody I've wanted to have on the show for a very, very long time. Ben Kessling is here, and if you follow the Wall Street Journal, you are very familiar with his byline because the guy has basically been everywhere. He's been, just in the last few months, he's been overseas, and in the last few weeks, he's been, in Bizarro World covering the presidential campaign. But he's a very, very interesting guy with a cool background, and I want to talk to him a little bit about that. Let's bring him in. Ben, how are you? Where are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I am sitting in Knoxville, Tennessee right now, just finished up at a Marco Rubio event here ahead of Super Tuesday.
Now, are you in a glamorous hotel suite, or are you calling us from a moving vehicle?
Hey, I am calling you from the Texas Roadhouse parking lot. So is that glamorous or
It sounds pretty glamorous. It sounds pretty glamorous. Ben, I want to talk a little bit about your route to the journal because I wouldn't say it's the most conventional pathway to newspaper reporting, but you know, you did go to journalism school. You're one of the fancy people from Medill University. I went to Wisconsin, so you know, we don't even get a look.
But before
from you guys
that,
in the
Jason,
hallway.
Let me interrupt. I looked, and Ben, you're from Lexington, Kentucky?
I am, yes.
I'm sure you've been...
I was born in Ohio, but raised a wildcat.
Okay, so before college, did you go to Keeneland a lot?
Oh, yeah. You got to, you know? I mean, the spring and fall meets. Go hang out in the clubhouse and make horrible bets after doing horrible handicapping. That was what I was very good at.
So you weren't a good handicapper?
No, I'm... really pathetic handicapper. The thing is, I can read this, you know, read the racing form and know what's going on, but it still doesn't assist me in any way picking the right horse.
Jim, for our non-degenerate gambling listeners, can you explain what Keeneland is?
So Keeneland Racecourse had hosted the Breeders' Cup this past fall, and it's known as one of the meccas of horse racing because it basically hosts a fall and a spring meet only for about a month or so all year. So it's only open 2 months of the year for live racing. And, you know, and it's viewed as one of the go-to places in horse racing.
A cathedral of the sport.
Yes. Would you say so, Ben?
Yeah. And the racing is just a kind of the sideshow. You know, you go to hang out in the clubhouse and have a few bourbons and ginger ale. That's the proper way to do it.
And the tailgate scene.
Oh, and then also not even having to deal with race season is the horse sale season. You go and hang out, go to this different stalls, see the horses that are being sold. These guys, you know, these things sell for quadzillion dollars sometimes, and that's a good scene too.
Ben, do you know that our Jim Charismi accurately picked the trifecta before the Derby in 2014? Was it, Jim?
Yes.
And there was a, just so you know, and all our listeners know, there was a little bit of an ethical conversation at the Journal with standards about whether or not Jim could keep the loot.
That is true, because I also cover horse racing, so it's sort of, I guess it would be like putting money on Marco Rubio to win a couple states on Super Tuesday.
No, because there's an expectation and, you know,
but there's no
gambling
inside information
is such a
in horse
part
racing.
Of horse racing culture.
Right.
You know, I would actually look askance at you if you didn't gamble while covering the sport of horse racing.
Fair enough.
I mean, with the presidential with the presidential primaries on the Republican side, I think you could just do a Trump Rubio Cruz and then box that, and you'd probably be better off.
You're already Jim's favorite guest of all time on the free for all, Ben. But I want to ask you about your military career, because you're a member of the United States Marine Corps. And how long did you serve?
I was in the Marines for about six and a half years.
And what did you do there?
I was a infantry officer. So, and after I finished, I went undergrad to Wabash College, a very small school in Indiana. Then went to graduate school, got my Master's of Divinity degree, of all things. And then after that, joined the Marine Corps and was an infantryman for about 6 years.
And what was that experience like?
I think anybody who has served in the military will say it's a formative, you know,
sure.
if not the formative experience, a formative experience in their life. And it was, I did two combat deployments, one to Iraq, one to Afghanistan, spent a lot of time in the Middle East, got to travel across the U.S. And it's an experience that I would not trade for anything, and something that I still draw on to this day when I'm doing coverage, whether it's long haul trips in the U.S. where you stay up for hours and hours at a time for a couple days sometimes or whatever, or back in the Middle East, being able to be familiar with combat zones and talking to soldiers from a number of different countries, and whether they be from the Middle East or from the U.S. or from abroad, that's all come in very handy.
I imagine that when you're in the field and you're overseas working as a reporter and you are serving as a war correspondent, the fact that you have this background must give you a substantial leg up in terms of sourcing, but just your own sort of personal intelligence of the subject.
It does make it, just being able to be familiar with weapons that you see.
Sure.
Or being able to say, oh, hey, that's an odd thing to see out here. What is that? Oh, it's exactly, you know, it's this piece of equipment that comes from Europe, from European allies, or it's a rocket launcher provided by the U.S. and being able to sort of piece those things together, and also just being able to when you're in a place like I was in Sinjar, when the Kurds liberated Sinjar, and just being able to be familiar with what an IED looks like, roadside bomb, and knowing whether or not that is that's something that has been defused properly or looks like it has been, or if it's something to might want to stay away from. So all that does play into the reporting quite a bit.
In your estimation, you know, this is a broad question, but where does the media, you know, have its, what's the media's biggest blind spot, would you say, in terms of the way that it covers military issues?
I mean, the blind spot that you find are, it's not a blind spot that's specific to the media. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, a lot of people, if you're not familiar with the culture of the military, or even the effects that certain weapons can have, it creates a pretty big blind spot. And I mean, just knowing what a bullet does to someone, knowing what a bomb does to a building, knowing what a rocket does when it goes into a window, just having a knowledge of the devastation or relative lack of devastation that comes from weaponry is a big thing. And then also just being able to navigate the acronyms and and the culture of the military. And the culture of the military is surprising connections across all cultures, whether it's U.S. or foreign.
I've noticed, you know, you have a great Twitter feed, and I've noticed on occasion that they're is a lot of misreporting that happens with regard to weaponry from reporters, you know, civilian reporters, and, you know, either, as you said, sort of overestimating impact or underestimating impact. But is there any way for someone to better themselves at that kind of knowledge base?
I mean, the one thing is you just have to know it. You have to have seen it before, and you need to have hands-on experience with it. I mean,
And this is from both sides of the aisle, mind you. I mean, this is from, you know, people who have absolutely a complete aversion to, you know, weapons and guns, and but also people who kind of are hyperbolically supportive of, you know, guns and also make sort of asinine comments.
Right. I mean, you know, hyperbolic statements. I mean, when there's talk of doing things like carpet bombing, you know, what does that mean?
Right.
And is that really what... You know, is that really what people are asking for, you know, like allies are asking for overseas, or, you know, being able to actually define some of these things is important. And I think that, you know, a lot of times with things like weaponry and explosives, unfortunately, you kind of have to see and experience it. I mean, it's, you know, it's, to know what it's like to run a football up the middle in a game, or to be hit you know, playing rugby or something, those feelings, you kind of get an idea of them by watching TV and seeing like, oh man, that guy got shook up, or holy smokes, that was an awful looking concussion that came from that. But when it comes to sort of weaponry and explosives, it's hard to get a feeling for what it's like to have a shockwave of an explosion kind of wash over you, or the sound of a ricochet or a bullet snapping over your head, and to, you know, see men or women who have had this happen to them, you know, be in a combat zone and know that's what it looks like when someone gets hit with a Hellfire missile. This is what it looks like when someone gets shot. Those are all things that unfortunately are very visceral, personal, up close experiences that I think it does well to be able to see those things yourself, but also to be able to in some way translate that and bring it back to people who have not seen that and cannot see that, and, you know, maybe not necessarily should have to in person.
When you made the transition from your military career to journalism, you know, how abrupt a change was that? Because, you know, you're in an environment, a combat environment, where, you know, things are very dramatic, obviously, for obvious reasons. You know, and not to say that you weren't doing, you know, risk-taking journalism since, but it's a different environment. And what was that transition like?
for me, I had a very good transition. I came out. I had a pretty good idea of where I was going, and I was married at the time. I am married and was married at the time. Had that support network set up. My wife and I knew where we were going. We went there, and it also I knew how to navigate the system for myself. I already had an undergraduate degree and a master's degree, was going back into graduate school.
Right.
Things were laid out pretty well. Yeah. And I was able to sort of advocate for myself and set things up. And, you know, from reporting on Department of Veterans Affairs stuff over the past couple of years,
yeah,
you see that that's not necessarily the case for a lot of people. And that transition can be really jarring and difficult, especially if you don't have a way to smoothly go from, hey, I'm driving a truck in the Army, or I'm fixing weapons in the Marine Corps, to being on the outside now,
sure,
not having a degree, not knowing how to use the GI Bill effectively. And that's a problem for some people, but for me it was a pretty smooth transition.
I mean, there are, you know, just a myriad of issues that are facing, you know, our active service people plus our veterans. But would you say that transition, and in terms of, you know, what this country can do to make that transition more natural, would you say that's as big a military issue as we have at this time?
It's certainly one of the military issues, right? Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of issues that come up perennially, and that transition has been an issue since time immemorial. You know, when you leave
yeah,
the service or yeah, combat or uniform service, you're a lot of times you've gone in as a high schooler. A lot of people will leave high school, join the military, and then when they come out,
right,
that's a problem. There have been a lot of changes, a lot of strides made to make that transition easier. But even now, going into Super Tuesday, when you listen to the candidates on the trail talk
yeah,
about things that need to be done, that transition is one of those things. And unfortunately, it'll always be an issue, because that transition is it's a very difficult thing. No matter how much you try to smooth it, when kids leave the house from
yeah,
after high school to college, or after college to try to find a job, it's not easy. And that sort of issue is a lot of times amplified because of that military transition. So I don't see it being solved anytime soon, but who knows if it can be. But there is constant work to alleviate it or make it easier.
I want to continue that thought and also come back. We have to pay for this extremely, extremely expensive podcast with an advertisement, and we'll be right back with the Wall Street Journal's Ben Kessling.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigne.
I'm Steve Grosser.
And this is the promo where we tell you how badly you're going to feel if you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast. You are going to feel worse than a sad trader on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally, worse than a Kardashian without hair care products.
Okay, Paul, I think we get the picture.
Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We are back with the Wall Street Journal journalist, Ben Kessling, who is currently on the road with the GOP campaign on the eve of Super Tuesday, but also talking about Ben's rather exceptional career before he got into journalism, which included several years serving with the United States Marine Corps. But let's get to really the most eccentric part of the resume, Ben, which is you are a Jeopardy champion. Jim is in love with you already. You love horses and you love Jeopardy. I'll let Jim ask the Jeopardy questions here.
Yeah, you know, Ben, like right before we came on, when Jason mentioned you were going to be on the show, you know, I Googled you and I was like, I said out loud, you know, Ben was on Jeopardy. I was very, very excited. So explain the experience. Do you get to interact with Alex at all?
No, it's almost as if Alex is hermetically sealed and kept in a package on the other side of the stage. And the only time that they kind of pull him out and let him come next to the contestants is at the end there, where they sort of roll the credits and everybody's standing there smiling. Well, one person's smiling because they just won a couple grand, and the other two are like, "Well, I just lost, so that's it." But that's the extent of the interaction.
You won 2 days?
I did. I won 2 days. Third day, lost because I did not answer in the form of a question on a daily double.
You lost on a technicality.
That's the way I like to think of it. Thank you. That's the way I like to think about it.
And what did
well.
You have bet? How much did you bet on that question?
I don't even remember. I think I've buried it in my psyche. Sort of, it'll come out on an analyst couch one day. But I don't even remember how much I bet. I just know that was sort of the precipice over which I went, and from there it was all downhill.
Now, the ones that you won, Ben, do you remember what the final Jeopardy was for the two ones that you won?
One of them was a musical theater question.
Okay.
And I whispered to the guy next to me when I didn't get it right, I said, "God, I'm glad I didn't know that question, because I'm not a musical theater guy." Okay. But if for anybody who's thinking about going on Jeopardy, the things that I recommend really studying are your musical theater, your Shakespeare titles, and Pope's names also are
really
are come up every so often. Yeah.
How much pregame studying did you do? Did you specifically, prep for it, everything?
I went and bought an almanac, like
okay.
the kind, like, you flip through when you're in fifth grade or something, and just kind of like in true dilettante fashion, just went through and looked through lists and checked this stuff out.
It's amazing.
It was a pathetic.
No, it sounds
really
incredible.
Now, also,
really,
so over 3 days, do they tape just one episode a day?
No.
Back to back.
An entire week's work in one day.
Okay.
Alex has golf to play, Jim. Come on.
So your experience was over one day then?
Yeah. Three shows. They tape them all before lunch. Yeah. And the third one, I lost. So I didn't even get. They didn't even give me a lunch ticket. They just like threw me out. So it was.
Did you have three separate outfits? I mean, you do outfit changes.
Yeah. You like? I can't remember if I changed shirt and tie or just tie. But I made the mistake of I've worn bow ties for the first 2 days, and I switched to a long tie.
Yeah.
And that's the curse right there. So.
Now, is the button as responsive as it seems on TV?
It's a hair trigger, yeah. It's set to Alexander Hamilton dual setting, like you barely touch it and it goes off.
Wow.
The buzzer is, that's the key. You got to ring in and then just trust that you'll know the answer, because you got like 3 seconds to answer it after you ring in. So if you kind of have an inkling that you'll get it, 3 seconds is an eternity.
And isn't it only activated? Isn't it only activated as soon as Alex finishes the question?
Yeah, but if you do it before that, it locks you out, and then you're done.
Like
a 2 second lockout or something like that.
Wow.
You gotta be wary and careful.
All right. Well, speaking of game shows, let's make the proper segue to this presidential campaign, which you have been around now for several months. You are with the Marco Rubio campaign at the moment, but you've also been with Mr. Trump a fair amount. As presidential campaigns go, this one seems to have moved to a place which we have really not seen in American history. But on the ground, does it feel as surreal as it seems when we're watching it on television and reading about it in the Wall Street Journal?
So the campaign that I've I'm kind of covering it here and there, buried in the coverage as some of the other
sure.
of the other reporters.
Sure.
But the Donald Trump campaign, I've gone to a few events for that across a few different states, and it is It is a spectacle. It's something to behold.
How so?
You know, neither good nor bad. I'm not passing judgment. I'm just saying it's incredible. I mean, lines stretching around the block, people selling buttons and badges and hats.
Selling them. Usually they give that stuff away.
Well, so the Trump people themselves will give some of that stuff away, but
right.
there's
a brisk secondhand market.
actually, there is. There's this one guy who he is doing beanie arbitrage. He like is selling these Trump campaign stocking caps that I guess you get if you're a donor or something, and he's out there flipping them on the street. So something for everybody, but. The sheer amount of swag that you can get at an event is incredible.
Now, Trump, my experience of watching Trump so far has been through the debates, and I think I've seen a little bit of campaign appearances here and there. But when he's doing a stump speech, does he even have a stump speech, or does he just wing it every time? Is it different every single time?
Well, he's got certain things that he hits every time, but yeah. One of his one of his big points is that he doesn't use a teleprompter, and it contributes to to hit this honest message that
right.
he's giving. So I know that sometimes it can cause the speeches to go a little long, and people will start to trickle out the back of the room before it's over. But for the most part, he kind of stays on point. Tells some of the same jokes and makes a lot of the same points over and over again. And there's audience interaction with it as well. So call and response with, what are we going to build? A wall? And, who's going to pay for it? And then Mexico,
the wall at this point is his stairway to heaven. Like people are there waiting for it to happen, right? It's like it's become a moment within the speech.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of like Stairway, or I guess it could be like Pink Floyd,
or like The Wall. Yeah, exactly. we see, of course, constant reminders that this candidacy has really been missed, or underestimated consistently by the quote unquote establishment and the punditocracy. And what from seeing it up close, do you get a vibe for what has been missed? What the sort of traditional political environment has missed about this campaign, and what's new about it?
I think the biggest thing that comes out from talking to people over and over again in different states, different rallies, who are there to listen to Mr. Trump or to or our supporters, is that he is bucking the system. It's a complete thumb in the eye of the establishment.
Of every part of it, right.
Yes. I mean, essentially. And any time. One thing that I found was really interesting was when you go to different rallies, you will see some, like, GOP swag at some of the Republican rallies, like I was just at Mr. Rubio's, and somebody had a Republican sweatshirt on.
Right.
Somebody else was wearing some other candidate stuff.
Right.
At a Donald Trump rally, it's Trump.
Right.
If there is anything that's GOP related, it'll be like an elephant with Donald Trump's hair superimposed upon it. So it's sort of everything is the GOP through the lens of Trump, and Mr. Trump wanting to bring the GOP either to his side or doing his own thing. And the sheer amount of frustration, anger that you see out there with people wanting to buck the system is that's what comes across loud and clear. And even at other rallies you go to. So one thing that I from talking to GOP voters, a lot of people will say, I don't consider myself to be a Republican. I'm an independent.
Right.
I'm an independent conservative.
Right.
And I just happen to have voted GOP my entire life and was president of the College Republicans.
Right.
But I'm an independent conservative. And I think that is a very important thing to note.
Because that's one of the things that, people who are making predictions here have consistently underestimated. They've sort of adhered to these old ideas of what
you know, Republican voters are or what their loyalties are too, and that there's this whole mass of people who aren't necessarily in the middle. I don't think that's an appropriate way of describing it, but they are not as attached to the establishment traditions as previously thought.
I mean, even now. I mean, it's just this campaign season has been. Even as we speak, who knows what's going to happen on Super Tuesday? It's so unpredictable the whole way, and the way that people you talk to, what they want or believe or think about the party, or think about issues will often not align 100% with the way that it appears they're going to vote or the person they're supporting. Extraordinarily hard to have any predictions. That's why, for the most part, I just want to report what's out there.
Yeah. With Rubio, since you've been with that campaign now for a few days, I get the vibe that they're trying to create this quote-unquote, what do they call it, Marcomentum or something, that, you know, Rubio is the, clear alternative to Trump. And I keep seeing, testaments to big crowds that he's drawing and new enthusiasm for him, and yet the knock is that he's yet to win a primary. And do you think we might get that Tuesday? I mean, I know you're not in the prediction business here, but do you feel anything tangible in terms of him picking up something tomorrow?
The voters that I talk to, they say, well, you never know what the polls are going to show. But I mean, there was a CNN poll that came out today, Monday we're talking, and there was a WSJ poll that came out yesterday that all show Mr. Trump with a commanding lead over everyone else, and Mr. Cruz doing pretty well in Texas, Mr. Rubio lacking the percentage points, sort of lagging behind in third place. And although there is this Marcomentum, where it seems to be more people talking about him, it's just there's so much support for Mr. Trump right now, either at rallies or in the polls. It's with a day to go, it looks like those polls are going to be accurate.
What do you get out of the Kasich camp? Because you spent a little bit of time with him too, as I believe up in Michigan.
I did.
The general thought is that he's going to hang around until we have the Ohio primary, where of course he's from. Also a person who's tried to position himself as a clear, if not antithetical, alternative to Trump, but yet to really make any kind of impact.
And one thing that that comes up when I'm talking to voters is they have a great deal of respect. A number of them have respect for Mr. Kasich and his background. Time in Congress, time as a governor, experience in the system, and he's really putting forth a lot of effort in Ohio and in Michigan to pull those states, but. I'm like we said earlier, I'm much better at drinking bourbon than handicapping the horse races. So.
All right. Well, listen, I want to close here by asking you an important question. Jim and I would like to recruit you over to the sports department. You are, of course, a very important journalist for the Journal, but, sports is really where it's at. And so we're going to give you the opportunity to pick out, if you had your dream sports writing gig, what would it be? What sports or what sort of events? Is there something we can sketch out in order to dissuade you from following around all these presidential candidates?
Well, I think that I spent some time in Scotland when I was in college, and I was always fascinated by the snooker and darts scene. And the fact that that men who smoke like chimneys, drink like fishes, and somehow also wear lovely waistcoats and bow ties, have a tremendous following.
And
do a great job. It seems like these they do a better job the more lager they drink. I think that's really
beat is open.
Yeah, we can make this happen, Ben. If again, if you get tired of this whole being a star roving correspondent thing, we can make darts and snooker
work. You know, we really can. The Journal is a global newspaper, as you know. We are expanding our global sports coverage. We have a bureau in London. We can get you hooked on cigarettes if that is a requirement. We can. This is an imaginable dream. You know, this can really happen.
Okay. Well, you know, last time I was in Baghdad, the Sumer cigarettes, which is the state manufactured cigarette in Iraq, they're back. They're doing a bang up job producing those, and you know, maybe we can get some sponsorship going with the state cigarette company of Iraq for this. I like this idea very much.
All right. Well, Ben, thanks so much for being a guest on the Free for All. You know, we're all in awe of all the stuff that you do, and Jim, most of all, because of the horsies and the Jeopardy.
Yeah, Keeneland's opening in 2 months.
Let's go.
All right. This has been the Free for All. I'm Jason Gay. Please check in with us and subscribe to us on iTunes. This is the Free for All on the WSJ Podcast Network.